Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The day after I arrived in New York in July 1990, I started looking for a job, attending to the relentless New York imperative of making money, and which didn't stop until I left nearly 4 years later. Over that summer, I had a dizzying array of jobs. The first was as a waiter, which lasted for all of 3 days, before a combination of my incompetence at what it entailed and my intolerance of the crankiness of some of the customers came to a head. I quit after a row with someone who wanted the savoury omelette, but without the egg. A quick succession of other jobs followed, as a furniture mover, a hellish job of climbing the equivalent of Kropatrick while lugging heavy furniture in 35 degrees of heat, as a focus group cameraman, as an office temp, and as a painter and decorator. And then finally that autumn, I came upon a job that fitted in with my life as it was then, being an art student by day and a co-check by night. Lousy pay, but the tips were good. My co-checking job was in a big, gleaming midtown hotel, and I worked at all sorts of events there. Dental conferences, the ubiquitous bar mitzvahs, charity bachelor auctions, think Love Island, cross with the Ballinasloe horse fair. I got a fascinating insight into America, simultaneously so familiar and so alien. I was invisible, a drone, attending to the whims of the wealthy. As autumn snuck into winter, temperatures plummeted, but more coats meant a lot more tips. December was frantic. I worked every night, including at parties for several New Jersey waste disposal companies. At one of them, suddenly, a bunch of loud men appeared, who looked like cartoon versions of people I'd seen in films, with names like Pauly and Sal, wearing big pinky rings, and with either bouffant hair or incredibly intricate comb-overs. And I was thinking to myself, no way. It's so obvious. They couldn't be. That was until a woman showed up with a fur coat, for which the coat room had strict protocols. You had to sign your ticket twice, and if your signature didn't match when you showed up to collect it, no fur coat. When I explained this to her, she demurred. Nah, if anyone stole my coat, they'd be dead before they'd have a chance to leave the damn building. No one tipped better, or for that matter, more ostentatiously than the mobsters. All pulled out of massive billfolds of cash. $10, $20 per coat. Most of the coat checks were students like me, or the working poor, holding down several jobs. I was usually rostered with a tall, skinny man from Georgia called Horace, and though we were like chalk and cheese, we got on pretty well. He was daft but funny and hard-working. He called me Gary, my actual name, and not Irish, what most of my co-workers called me. And also, unlike the others, Horace was curious about the people who passed in front of us and about the wider world. In the down times, we'd swap tales about our respective lives. He was interested in the minutiae of Irish life, such as what actually happened at the Wesley Disco. And he would ask me all sorts of inquisitive questions like, did Irish people really love potatoes? Which I tried to answer. In return, he loved telling me dark but funny stories about being poor and gay in rural Georgia. Later that winter, we were working at a small party for some Wall Street wasps, the worst tippers. While it was quiet, and in the lull that had settled in, against all my advice, Horace decided to try on a full-length black fur coat that had been left into us. Next thing, he proceeded to Vogue. Then all the rage. Up and down the coat room he moved, striking extravagant poses, pretending to be its actual owner, while at the same time providing an hilarious running commentary as he went. Suddenly the door burst open, revealing our boss, who we had thought had gone home. Being so horrified by what she saw, she couldn't actually speak at first. Eventually, with her breath back, and in a gesture that is now sadly all too familiar, she pointed an accusatory finger and spat out a venomous, "You're fired," at Horace. As he gathered his stuff, I split the tips and handed Horace his share. Just as he was about to exit, he turned around and I saw he was smiling. When am I ever again in this life going to have a chance to wear a $50,000 sable fur coat? And letting out his infectious laugh, he swept out the door.
La merde was, say my companions. The other Irish Sea, they say, and the gesture out of the ferry window. We are in Brittany, on the early morning boat that sails west across the ocean from Brest. It is a long Pentecost weekend in France, and the boat is full of holidaymakers. We are all of us sailing for the Isle of Wesson, just there on the horizon. The westernmost point in France, and the largest island in La Mer d'Oise, and my destination for a month's writer's residency, is a semaphore beside a lighthouse with the most powerful beam in Europe. This is a time for superlatives. But first, La Mer d'Oise, the other Irish Sea. My Breton companions organised the Summer Writers' Festival on Wesson and a residency which I've been awarded. And they are accompanying me to see me settled in, to introduce me to the people of Wesson, to make sure I have everything I need, a bike, a torch, a handle on bakeries and fish shops. And as the ferry leaves the harbour, they speak of the archipelago of Skerries and just a few inhabited islands that lie sprinkled across the sea between Brest and Wesson. These are swirling waters, filled with the telltale white lines of currents and of rocks that have claimed many lives over many centuries. The age-old story of fishing communities, the men of Wesson went to sea and the women stayed at home, worked the land, raised the children, kept the houses in repair and watched the horizon, scanning the treacherous seas which all too often took the lives of their loved ones. And other disasters, the steamship Drummond Castle, which foundered off the Wesson coast in 1896 with the loss of over 200 lives, and the tanker Amoco Cadiz, and here my Breton companions shudder, which struck rocks and sank north of Wesson in 1978, and slicked the coast of the island and of Brittany with oceans upon oceans of oil. And why Iroise? Why an Irish sea? But here, a glance at the map tells its own story. Westernmost Brittany and the southern coasts of Ireland are not, after all, so very far apart. And the seas in Irish culture have always been a highway, rather than any kind of barrier. And humans travel, have always travelled. And the Bretons have for centuries been accustomed to the Irish fetching up on their rocky coasts. As the ferry purrs across the water, we speak of the wild geese flying to Brittany and of the United Irishmen, of Wolfe Tone waiting impatiently at Brest Harbour in 1796, of the eventual sailing for Bantry in December of that year, of an ill-starred French fleet of 43 ships under General Hoche. And we speak of infinitely more ancient history, of the age-old cultural kinship and the similarity in coastlines and seascapes and weather that meant, that has always meant, that Irish travellers have felt a connection to this Atlantic corner of France. And then, of course, the language. The Isle of Wesson is Enes Usa in Breton. Enes? Enish? And I nod and laugh and, yes, I see, I say, and in my terrible French, oui, je comprends. The ferry pushes further out into the open ocean, and now I feel the pull and heave of La Mer d'Oise. The seas foam with white breakers on hidden rocks, and I understand the skill of the sailors who know these waters and the fears of those left at home. We pause in the harbour of Moulins, a little island that lies eerily low in the water, and now we make the final crossing towards Wesson. If Moulins is low, Wesson is high. Sheer cliffs rise abruptly from the waves, and a lighthouse, Wesson and La Mer d'Oise are full of lighthouses, there on the cliff edge. A modern harbour wall, striking, contemporary, beautiful, studded with round apertures through which the sea pours and flows. The violence of the winter storms on Wesson would pulverise the solid harbour wall. So the islanders design in such a way as to live with the sea, to bend to its ways. I look away from those sheer cliffs and I see that Wesson is green and lush, pink sea thrift and succulents glowing pink and orange on the edge of the harbour itself. I remember that the theme of this year's Island Literary Festival is James Joyce and Ulysses. And as if on cue, my companions turn to me and smile and say, Bienvenue à Ithaca. Welcome to Ithaca. And now I step ashore.
When my only daughter said she was getting married, we were delighted. She was in love with a good man who was in love with her. So far, so good. The next question was, had she set the date? And what kind of wedding was planned? It was to be a classic wedding. Bridesmaids, groomsmen, and appropriate mother of the bride attire would be needed. It was a long engagement, with a date set for almost 2 years in the future. This was a relief. I was a late starter in many things in my life, and having babies was no exception. This daughter was born when I was pushing 40, so I realised being mother of the bride was going to be a challenge when I set about looking online at appropriate fashions for the occasion. I found images of thin women in those dress, jacket, hat combinations and very high heels that are not designed for a portly woman measuring 5'2" in her stocking feet. I also found a lot of flowery chiffon. Enough said. Rejecting the online options, I trekked with the bride-to-be to every outlet in Dublin and then ventured into neighbouring counties. The overwhelming judgment was that I was too big. No one said that, of course, but when XXL doesn't fit you and when you squeeze yourself into outfits, even ones costing a lot of money, and there are women muttering about being able to let it out, you know you're in trouble. Then there was the hair. Even before COVID, I had decided to stop dyeing it and let it go grey. The problem was that it didn't go uniformly so, but remained a stubborn dark shade at the back, with a yellowish white section around the forehead and temples. There was a certain skunk-like vibe about it. Then, for the first time in my life, I began to worry about my teeth. They were my own, My poor mother had dentures before she was out of her 40s, so I was proud of this, until now. A radical makeover took place. I got new caps on my front teeth. I spent more money than I can admit on reshaping and dyeing my hair. I got new glasses. I had my eyebrows tinted and threaded. The pain involved surprised me greatly. I did not go on a diet. I have been struggling with my weight for over 50 years now, and I have surrendered. Neither did I resort to shapewear. After an experimental outing in one such garment ended in a very embarrassing episode in the ladies' room of a renowned department store. I had to lock myself in a cubicle, take off all my clothes, and get help to extricate myself in order to breathe again before I fainted. I imagined myself in less wholesome circumstances, with a couple of gin and tonics on board, and decided that wearing my own shape was preferable. My daughter, meanwhile, with little fuss, had found the perfect wedding dress, all the appropriate accessories, dressed her bridesmaids, advised on the groomsmen, and organised the whole day. But I was still looking. We got there in the end. I found a dress. A hat, shoes, and a bag were purchased and deemed appropriate by the steering committee, and I was all set. While the wedding wasn't in a church, the walking down the aisle tradition was to be observed. Our little family is made up of my son, my daughter and I. So we agreed that her brother and I would enter the ceremony room on each side of the bride and walk her to her groom. There was no prouder woman in the world at that moment when the three of us stepped into view and the celebrant prompted a round of applause. Everyone stood up and turned around to get a good look at us. The bride was stunning in ivory. My son was rocking it in a beautiful suit. And I was after spending 2 years and a lot of money to look as good as humanly possible for this exact moment. I looked around the room and saw the women there who had helped me raise 2 children, sometimes in chaotic and heartbreaking circumstances, to become the 2 fine young adults walking beside me. As the applause became more raucous and turned to cheering and tears, I knew that I could have been walking down that room in a sack, because all that mattered that day was love. The couple's love for each other, my son and his wife, my partner and I, and all those friends wishing them a long and happy life together. Because love, although far from blind, looks with the heart and not with the eye.
One night, as I was cooking mushrooms for dinner in my Dublin kitchen, I was surprised to receive a phone call from Michael Graves. Would a teaching position at Princeton be of interest? Taking this to be a call from a joking friend, I laughed, cursed the phony caller, and hung up. The telephone rang again, and unperturbed, Michael Graves, then at the height of his fame as an international architect and an influential professor at Princeton, graciously apologized for that abrupt break in connection and politely repeated his invitation. Short notice, admittedly, but would I be prepared to consider coming over to teach with him that semester? He remembered my work from a group exhibition he'd seen at the Architectural Association in London. The semester would start in 3 weeks. I could work with him to set the design brief. That teaching opportunity at Princeton was my introduction to America, the USA having been considered off-limits when I was a student, its allure tainted by the horrors of the not-so-long-ago Vietnam War. I was picked up at the airport in a limousine, whisked past the movie familiar but still distant Manhattan skyline, to arrive at a prim and proper guesthouse in this sleepy university town. I was greeted by the genial dean. "Hello, John. Welcome to Princeton. Would you like a glass of white wine or perhaps a crap after your long journey?" I settled into an austere apartment borrowed from a visiting professor, a mentor from my early years working in London. Spacious and Spartan, with rooms full of books that maintained his silent aura, but not a novel in sight. 3 mornings a week, teaching in the design studio, a small group of graduate students for me to work with, then a handy train ride into New York, where my American education developed, street by street, block by block, week by week. New York felt more old-fashioned than I might have expected. Cast iron radiators hissed in the night. Steam rose out of gratings in the street. The subway clattered under bulky steel girders. Bathroom taps, fancifully known as faucets, operated like clunky prototypes, gushing flows of piping hot water. The skyline of New York seemed nostalgic for the 20th century, a young city that hadn't moved far from the shape of its foundations. It was new and exciting, but old and restoring at the same time, the thickness of steel plates thrown down to cover a hole in the road, the width of the paving stones in front of the New York Public Library. The skyscrapers, satisfyingly solid, hit the ground without much of a fuss, sitting down squarely on relatively small plots. The blocks were regular and easy to navigate. The city had a reassuring continuity about it. Restaurants and bars were buzzing, like I knew they would be from so many nights in the cinema. Find me a cozier club, a less pretentious scene than the basement of the Village Vanguard. Famous from classic jazz recordings, the place itself turned out to be comfortingly shabby, if a little hard to find, hiding in plain sight. I took a ride on the Staten Island ferry because I knew it had to be done. I didn't bother to alight on the island side, returning on the same ticket. But the rumble and vibration of its departure, the voyage across the wide river, the view to the Statue of Liberty, the throbbing sensation of the ferry docking heavily into its jetty, made this as much of a mythical journey as any imagined descent into Hades. My first day in Manhattan, as I sat in a coffee bar on Broadway, a homeless man stared in at me from out on the street. Then, striding back the width of the sidewalk, he sprang full tilt, flinging himself to land four square, 2 feet and both hands up against the plate glass, the window flexed inwards in its frame. I must have looked worried to the waitress. "Ah, shucks, he does that 4-5 times a day. You want another coffee, honey?" After that unsettling rite of initiation, I hailed a yellow cab and, settling in the back seat, gave the driver the exact address of an architecture gallery on Canal Street. He pulled over to the curb and hollered, "You want to get out of the car?" Apparently, or so I was sharply told, you go by cross street intersections, not by house numbers, in this most numbered city. Why do deadly dull names like Fifth Avenue or 42nd Street carry so many sentimental associations? How can endlessly straight avenues, numbered simply 1 to 9, communicate so much image-laden information? And why does all this rudeness, beeping horns, lane-dodging yellow taxis, lights flashing, walk, don't walk, seem so consoling? Gotham City's got a lot shinier than it seemed on my first expedition in 1987, but it hasn't lost its charm. I value my connections, personal and academic, with America. Like every Irish child of my generation, I grew up with the idea of America in my bones. Admittedly, my contact with that society has been limited to the Northeast Fringe, a sympathetic arena where I've made lasting friendships. It was suggested to me at a post-lecture dinner in Baltimore that an aerial survey of foul drainage systems could help discriminate red from blue states. Where the streets and houses are connected to a public sewage network, you could assume one sort of political majority, widespread reliance on septic tank disposal would be downright proof of a different predilection in the population. One demographic knew how much they depended on one another. The other shower believed they could go it alone. These days, I travel to America for teaching or for work, always eager for the inspiration of its anonymous building tradition and the brilliance of its 20th century architecture, mightily impressed by the monumental geology of its canyon landscapes, and marvelling still at the street canyons of old New York.
I say goodbye to all my sorrows, and by tomorrow I'll be on my way. I guess the Lord must be in New York City.
A polite young man of a dropped, gaping jaw struggled to divert his gaze. Cup of tea in hand, he appeared to suffer from a sudden bout of what my mother would call stunism. It was no wonder, hadn't his beautiful dance date just ripped the wig off her head, only to fling it on the sofa where it landed, along with the same swift movement that brought her through the door only minutes before. Her large, bulbous, pink, sweaty forehead revealed itself, dented in by a greenish-white crease line where the wig had previously been digging into her skin. So much reality, so little illusion, the abrupt breaking of a spell. What was the source of his repulsion? Was he someone of such superficial leanings, or was it an illusion he had fallen for? And why had such a heaving turn been visited on him? My mother reenacted this event for us many times. I loved the brave honesty of the woman in the story and her lack of desire to maintain her self-created illusion. I was fascinated at how someone could be so confident to do such a thing in front of someone she had just been on a date with. My own experience of wig wearing is different. Early in my performing career, while on tour in America and on a budget, I shared a hotel room with two musicians. I didn't know them well, and one of them was very much in awe of my music and artistry. And realizing that I was in a bind because I was wearing an adorned wig, I resolved that I would just sleep with the wig firmly attached to my head, hairpins and brightly coloured headband in place, even though the getup was remarkably uncomfortable. The same musicians nowadays enjoy recounting the night when I slept in all my clothes, full makeup and wig, simply because I was so professional. Years later, when I was co-presenting a music series for radio, it was unexpectedly announced that we would be doing a photo shoot on that very day. I was utterly thrown. Miles from home, I didn't have the wig with me. Getting my hands on it would mean someone having to break into my house to get it before getting it to me. Even so, the absolute necessity for me was clear. I needed the wig. But it doesn't stop there. I need things on top of the wig. A friend of mine, who has worn a dicky bow every day of his life, once asked me why I wore that owl hat on my head when I was singing. He wanted to know what I needed it for. "Can you not just sing the songs?" he said. Another voice from the ether of my past goes, "He's 60 years blown the same old trumpet, and not everyone liked it either, you know." I think of the many times I've been asked, "And are you still at the old music now, Julie? And would you be at that now all day?" And it all well meant. But could I have also heard, "A right good clip of all wings she needs. Sure they were saying 'twas only some old class of a jingle thing she was at." It's definitely hard succeeding in living life as an artist, and it can be regarded by some as a fanciful indulgence, even to be one, but it's a compulsion that I can't shake off. Creative impulses pass through me like indescribable flashes, coaxing and luring me to inhabit a place in my mind. They propel a flight for me into a newly painted world. Visual objects hold so much story, resonance and magic for me. Whether reaching into an undiscovered dimension in my performance, or committing to a persona or a character by wearing a wig or a hat, the visual world gives me fire. Fire to express myself in the ways that I am best at. There, I can truly be free. Now, where is that wig?
Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair, shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxing, waxing. Give me down to there, hair, shoulder length longer.
Of Greece, I can tell about the sun, how it struck the villa's blue door as we climbed the steps, sealed it into a curtain of ice. A donkey with suitcases strapped to its back. Among ruins, we played at gods, and the spines of sea urchin you tried to tweeze from my feet splintered into black specks. Absence is the new order, I remind myself each time I re-enter the world alone. Or on evenings when, forgetful, I reach out for the stoneware plate on the topmost shelf. I labor hard just to hover. You, the clapperless bell, who met my every question with silence. I'm trying my best here. In the farmer's market, a stranger passes me sprigs of lavender. Their smell bitter. What mercy is small enough to fit? By the time we reached Crete, the spines had faded from the pink surface of skin, dull, so that I forgot about their venom, its quiet radiation within.
This morning's program was a selection of scripts from recent archives. We heard Horace by Gary Coyle, The Other Irish Sea was by Neil Hegarty. All You Need Is Love was by Kathy Power. Discovering America was by John Toomey. The Wig by Julie Feeney. And Of Greece, a poem by Lauren Green. And the music, Wigwam by Bob Dylan. Pores Gore by Jan Tiersen. Child of Mine by Carol King. I Guess the Lord Must Be in New York City, written by Harry Nielsen and performed by Sinead O'Connor. And Hair, sung by the Cowsills. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE Radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. This morning's programme was produced by Cliona Nianluan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.